Better? Okay, cool. Okay, so after that little hiatus of weirdness, okay. So anyway, so to recap all of that, the fathers at Vatican II, lots of very rapid social change, lots of things going on very quickly. And this historical context of having gone through these two world wars, the Cold War, communism, all this kind of stuff. One of the things that the fathers could see was a spirit of rebellion against values, which, having begun in the Protestant Reformation and continued in the Enlightenment, in many ways would overwhelm Western society. But what they do not seem to envision is that the rebellion against virtues would turn into a rebellion against the whole idea of virtue itself, into what Cardinal Ratzinger would so elegantly term the dictatorship of relativism. Okay, you've heard that term, right? In which, once truth becomes relative and everybody can kind of, decide what they want for themselves, then, there's a tendency for that to be imposed on other people as well, as part of the kind of logical contradiction of relativism. Now, remember that Vatican II, in a certain way, is trying to incarnate John the 23rd's optimism and desire for not hurling anathemas at the modern world, right? Remember how we talked about, the Orthodox Church and Orthodoxy Sunday, where they chant the anathemas from the ecumenical councils, right? Okay, John the 23rd really not interested in doing that, right? And Gaudium et Spes is taking note of that. And it's also taking its cue from the Christological orientation of the document on the church. Remember how last week, or 2 weeks ago, in Lumen Gentium, we talked about this kind of Christological orientation for any of our discussion on the church. But Gaudium et Spes also presents a stinging critique on the modern world. And so in a sense, I think you could say that it's kind of like the church's tale of two cities. Pope Benedict XVI, his theology, and remember, of course, he was present at the council as a theological peritus, was profoundly influenced by St. Augustine's idea of two cities. If you read, one of his most famous works is The City of God, and he talks about how there are these two cities, right? The city of God and the city of man at war with each other because of their various ideas. And Vatican II was an attempt, or at least for many of the Council Fathers, to try to bridge the gap a little bit more between the city of God and the city of man. Okay? Instead of saying, okay, well, these are two entirely different things that have absolutely nothing to do with each other, that maybe there's a way to bridge that gap between them, right? Gaudium et Spes introduces a philosophy of man, an anthropology, remember anthropology is kind of the science of man, based on Jesus Christ. Remember how we talked about there's this very decidedly Christocentric approach to everything in the council. Paragraph 12, all things on earth should be related to man as their center and crown, end quote. And in doing so, what is in modern society which is at variance with the Christ-centered ideal of man becomes clearer. Now, remember when we talked about, and we talked about this a little bit when we were talking about Lumen Gentium, Vatican I. Okay? Gaudium et Spes is speaking to a world which they consider to be very different than the world that the fathers at Vatican I were talking to. Paragraphs 22 to 24 presents a charter for a new Christian humanism, okay? A way of living in the world which is authentically of this world, but also imbued with a Christian spirit. So gone are the condemnations of democracy and progress as the church struggles to address a new situation in the life of man. Now, I think there's a question, though. Okay. Whether or not Gaudium et Spes succeeds in bridging the gap between St. Augustine's cities of God and man. Okay. George Weigel, in an interview on the 40th anniversary of the document, he's a noted American theological writer, wrote, "One might also ask whether Gaudium et Spes was a bit too sanguine about the main currents of late 20th century intellectual life." The more cynical among meditators on the document may bring to mind Oscar Wilde's aphorism, "It is only the modern that ever becomes old-fashioned," end quote. This is one of the things which is important to kind of struggle with. When, as a church, we try to become relevant, do we become irrelevant in doing that? And I think, and I'm not saying that because I think that there's one particular answer in that. Is that the case? And if it is the case, then how it, is it the case? How is it possible to address the real concerns of people in the here and now, but at the same time propose to them, as John the 23rd said, this ancient message, and still keep it in its same sense, in its same message, right? This is kind of an interesting thing. As we seek to find the correct interpretation of the documents of Vatican II, this raises the question, did Vatican II accomplish what it set out to do? And one of the best ways in which we can begin to gauge this question is by seeing what has come of the longest and the most hotly debated document of the Council, Gaudium et Spes. I don't know about you, but as I read Gaudium et Spes and I think about what is there, and then I look at our world today, I think, well, you know, maybe if some people had paid attention to some of what's in there, then we wouldn't be dealing with some of the stuff that we're dealing with, right? It really is kind of an incredible thing. Now, remember how throughout this course we have gone back to what I consider the corresponding encyclical of Pius XII, right? Now, so we're going to go into Humani Generis a little bit. What makes Gaudium et Spes unique among church documents, okay, is not only its length, right, its comprehensive style, its wordiness, right, it marks a change in the method by which the church's magisterium would approach the modern world. Okay? Now, you can take any collection of the documents of the previous ecumenical councils, including those of Vatican II itself, and not find its length and wordiness, okay, but also not its attempt to exhort, right? Its attempt to engage. The style of most official church documents is terse, to the point, and usually condemns errors in propositional form, namely, if you believe X, you're not a Catholic, right? But also exhorting faithfulness to the tradition. If you read most church documents until Gaudium et Spes, that's kind of the modus operandi, right? Now, John the 23rd was convinced that hurling anathemas at the world was not going to convert it. Okay? And this was not something that just kind of came out of nowhere with John the 23rd. Pius the 12th once said, "The world is not convinced by arguments, but by example." Already in Pius XII, there is a style in his encyclicals which is more than just condemning errors. There's an attempt to engage the errors in discussion and to provide fuller teaching on the truth. As the church could not count merely on its own moral authority anymore to persuade the hearts of men, Gaudium et Spes marks a turn in official church verbiage. The church seeks to explain, to exhort, to classify, and to inspire in a way that she has never done before. In doing so, however, the church is no longer just making truths clearer, but she's doing her own theological reflection as she does so, advancing the progress of theology through magisterial documents. Okay? Now, this trend is very apparent in Vatican II. We've seen this in the documents that we've gone through. But it has its faint echoes in Pius XII, most notably in Humani Generis. Now, at first glance, you know, as you're reading Humani Generis and then you're reading Gaudium et Spes, you can be like, I really don't see kind of how these are related. I don't really get how. Well, we're going to talk about that a little bit. Pius XII begins his 1950 document with, in paragraph 2, "Discord and error have always existed outside of the fold of Christ." Okay. So in this, he expresses the Catholic doctrine that the church is preserved from teaching error on faith and morals. But he is aware that many voices in humanity accuse the church of error, especially on two major points, evolution and the origin of mankind from one set of parents. Okay? Pius grants the possibility of theistic evolution while resolutely condemning the idea that man could have just evolved at different points from other first sets of parents, an idea called polygenism. Now, of course, for those of us who are reading this today, I mean, most of us are like, this is really kind of a no-brainer, right? I mean, we don't even think about this kind of stuff anymore. But even as late as 1950, this was still kind of a big deal. While these ideas that we mentioned, theistic evolution and the condemnation of polygenism, are principally scientific in nature, Pius is conscious of the fact that not a few people are ready to sacrifice doctrinal integrity if science seems to be in contradiction to it. Okay? Paragraph 14. In theology, some want to reduce to a minimum the meaning of dogmas, and to free dogma itself from terminology long established in the church and from philosophical concepts held by Catholic teachers, to bring about a return in the explanation of Catholic doctrine to the way of speaking used in Holy Scripture and by the fathers of the church. They cherish the hope that when dogma is stripped of the elements which they hold to be extrinsic to divine revelation, it will compare advantageously with the dogmatic opinions of those who are separated from the unity of the church, and that in this way they will gradually arrive at a mutual assimilation of Catholic dogma with the tenets of the dissidents. What group of people does this sound like that we talked about before? Starts with an M. The modernists. Okay. So he's still, you know, dealing with the fact that modernism is alive and well in 1950. Now, remember when we talked about last week the theological school of the Nouvelle Théologie, right? Here is where in this document, in Humani Generis, Pius XII does something very interesting. He gives the Nouvelle Théologie a very powerful yellow caution light. Okay? He doesn't just give a green light and say, go for it, boys, do it. Okay? It's a kind of a, okay, go, but tread carefully. Right? He calls such thinkers in the church advocates of novelty and says, these advocates of novelty easily pass from despising scholastic theology to the neglect of and even contempt for the teaching authority of the church itself, which gives such authoritative approval to scholastic theology. This teaching authority is represented by them as a hindrance to progress and an obstacle in the way of science. Some non-Catholics consider it as an unjust restraint, preventing some more qualified theologians from reforming their subject. And although this sacred office of teacher in matters of faith and morals must be the proximate and universal criterion of truth for all theologians, since to it has been entrusted by Christ our Lord the whole deposit of faith, sacred scripture and divine tradition, to be preserved, guarded, and interpreted, still the duty that is incumbent on the faithful to flee also those errors which more or less approach heresy, and accordingly to keep also the constitutions and decrees by which such evil opinions are proscribed and forbidden by the Holy See, is sometimes as little known as if it did not exist. Paragraph 18. Okay. That's a long sentence, isn't it? Okay. But what Pius is saying here is that, okay, these kind of new theological projects, okay, there's something there, we need to explore this, but at the same time, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, right? And don't do so in a way thinking, y'all got all the answers, and y'all going to do this right, because just chill out. It's a little bit more complicated than that, right? And certainly, don't get on your high horse about it, and you know, start saying that the church doesn't know what she's talking about, because the church, as mother and teacher, mater et magistra, knows a lot more than you, individual theologian, who think you figured it out. Right, this is kind of his, you know, kind of, okay, people, get a clue, right? Now, Pius XII here really does realize his office of prophet. Okay, remember that the church has this prophetic office as well, and sometimes we see this in these documents. Pius IX, so remember we talked about that first condemnation of modernism, had said, the most noble office of theology is to show how a doctrine defined by the church is contained in the sources of revelation. And then he added these words, with very good reason, in the sense in which it has been defined by the church. Okay. Pius XII sees that theologians will begin to work not only outside of the framework of the visible church, but even outside of reason and revelation itself. prostrating itself to the currents of the world. Okay? There was a real kind of nervousness here. While John the 23rd's project of, remember we had these two fun words, one which was Italian and one which is French. Remember, we talked about aggiornamento, right? The updating of the church. Okay? And then we have our fun French word, ressourcement, that return to the sources. While John the 23rd's project of aggiornamento, updating the church, and the theological project of ressourcement, of return to the fathers, it didn't have to have its center outside the church at all, right? There's no reason why it had to. But the reality is that many theologians felt themselves vindicated by the council to do so, even where they were flatly contradicted by the council texts themselves. They're like, Vatican II is the open door to say whatever we want, and there's a bunch of people who've annoyed us for so much time, all those like really annoying kind of, you know, Neo-Thomas theologians, and we're going to stick it to them, right? Okay. Remember how we talked about, you know, the whole hermeneutic, that key of interpretation. Such is the appeal to the spurious spirit of Vatican II, divorced from the historical context and the reality and the text of the council. Whenever people throw spirit of Vatican II in your face, you've got to be careful and say, what do you mean by that exactly? Is there a spirit to the documents which is more than just what is narrowly contained in the words themselves? Of course, just the same thing as in the scripture, right? But that spirit can only be discerned when we also take into consideration the actual text, the reality, the historical context, the intensio auctoris. Remember, we keep coming back to that. Okay. Now, the principal place where theologians would begin at first to dissent and then revolt, invoking Vatican II while tearing away from it, was in moral theology. Now, I didn't have this in my notes, but one of the things that I think it's kind of useful to explain is that the way that theology was often taught before Vatican II, everything had kind of disintegrated into these specializations that weren't necessarily all... Because, I mean, you know, when you teach, you know, algebra, it's got to be different than geometry. You know, you got to kind of, you know, make some distinctions here. But to a certain extent, certain things had been so balkanized that it was very difficult to kind of draw connections. Moral theology, for a very long period of time, was considered to be a subset of canon law, okay? Not as a discipline in its own right. So it's like, you know, you have the big book of canon law, right? So which is kind of, you know, the things which govern our common life in the church. Moral theology was just a subset of that. And so when you studied moral theology, it was very common to do it by way of what was called casuistry. So you would study all these cases, right? So you're like, okay, well, you know, if, you know, Bob marries Belinda and then they get divorced, but yet in the divorce, there's an African pygmy who comes in and says that needs to be baptized, but she's actually a Jew, and so how does that work if they need an annulment? I mean, you know. Okay, so you would get these cases, and the idea was that you would analyze these things in the light of Scripture and tradition and the magisterial teaching of the church to figure out what moral principles apply and how. The problem is, when you're doing it as a subset of canon law, it seems like that the entirety of the moral life is merely conforming to juridical norms, right? So when people talk about a kind of legalistic framework in the church before Vatican II, that's not entirely off the mark, because the way moral theology was taught was as a subset of canon law. With Vatican II, all of that really changes, and we're going to talk a little bit about this. The problem is the people who just flat out dissented from the teaching of the church, moral theology was kind of their inroad, right? They weren't like freaking out because Vatican II called the church the universal sacrament of salvation, right? They weren't freaking out because, you know, Revelation has one deposit of Scripture and tradition. You know, dogma was not kind of the problem. Moral theology is where the rubber hits the road, and Gaudium et Spes is involved in this discussion. Now, but we got to kind of back up the train a little bit. In 1932, Pius XI, who is one of the most underrated popes of modern times, unfortunately, he really was quite a fascinating guy in many respects. Pius XI issued a famous encyclical called Casti Connubii. which was the first church document to really flesh out Catholic doctrine on the sacrament of marriage as actually lived by couples in the modern world. Up until this point, the church's teaching on marriage was almost entirely formulated in terms of canon law, right? Okay. And you may see this, you may hear this and be like, well, this is really strange, right? Because we've been so used to this whole very rich teaching that comes from Vatican II and the post-Vatican II period about the sacrament of marriage. But before, it was just kind of a subset of canon law and, you know, just do it right and do the contract right and don't bother me, right? That was kind of, you know, not a lot outside of that. Casti Connubii really began to change that. Now remember, what was going on in 1932? Okay, you have this backdrop in which you have Nazi-inspired eugenicists such as Margaret Sanger, the founder of Planned Parenthood, who were perfecting artificial methods of contraceptives to further racist ideologies. Okay. This is one of the things that is going on, right? And so Pius XI offers a reaffirmation of the traditional teaching that marriage is for the procreation of children and the union of the spouses. And in doing so, condemns divorce, abortion, and artificial contraception. Now, fast forward to Gaudium et Spes. Chapter 1 of Part 2 of Gaudium et Spes harkens back to the wisdom of Casti Connubii. Quote, this is paragraph 47. Yet the excellence of this institution is not everywhere reflected with equal brilliance, since polygamy, the plague of divorce, so-called free love, was the 60s, right, and other disfigurements have an obscuring effect. In addition, married love is too often profaned by excessive self-love, the worship of pleasure, and illicit practices against human generation, end quote. Now, one of the things that is very problematic about Gaudium et Spes, though, is that it's obviously upholding pretty much intact the teaching of Casti Connubii, but it does seem to take at face value the myth of world overpopulation. Remember, especially in the 1950s and 60s, there was a lot of kind of propaganda campaign from all kinds of sectors that basically the world was going to be overpopulated in a very short period of time and there wouldn't be enough resources and we're all screwed, basically. Right? Well, here we are in 2016, and now we have Russia literally paying people to have children. Right? Okay, so obviously, you know, Gaudium et Spes kind of skirts around this because a lot of the fathers were listening to all of this stuff and thinking, oh my gosh, this is a problem. But yet at the same time, you know, Casti Connubii, what do we do with that? Now, the chapter on family life presents a positive affirmation of the church's traditional teaching on marriage and the role of Catholic families in the modern world, even as it decries departures from that teaching and perversions of that role. Paragraph 49, in particular, exalts for the first time in a church document sex within the covenant of marriage in a way which does not immediately also refer to concupiscence, right, to the disordered desires of the fallen human heart. I'm going to read a long quotation here. Quote, "The actions within marriage by which the couple are united intimately and chastely are noble and worthy ones. Expressed in a manner which is truly human, these actions promote that mutual self-giving by which spouses enrich each other with a joyful and ready will. Sealed by mutual faithfulness and allowed above all by Christ's sacrament, this love remains steadfastly true in body and in mind, in bright days or dark." Sounds like a marriage vow kind of thing, doesn't it? "It will never be profaned by adultery or divorce. Firmly established by the Lord, the unity of marriage will radiate from the equal personal dignity of wife and husband, a dignity acknowledged by mutual and total love. The constant fulfillment of the duties of this Christian vocation demands notable virtue. For this reason, strengthened by grace for holiness of life, the couple will painstakingly cultivate and pray for steadiness of love, large-heartedness, and the spirit of sacrifice. Authentic conjugal love will be more highly prized, and wholesome public opinion created about it if Christian couples give outstanding witness to faithfulness and harmony in their love, and to their concern for educating their children also, if they do their part in bringing about the needed cultural, psychological, and social renewal on behalf of marriage and family." Now, if you read this and you're one of the people that he's talking about. You're like, yeah, this is great. You know, we're going to take over the world with the great marriages, and it's an awesome, great thing. Well, the fathers were super optimistic about this, right? They were like, marriage is great, guys. Go out and have lots of babies, and the world's going to be totally renewed by all of this. Well, I don't need to tell anybody in this room, of course, that a little off the mark there. If anything, families adhering to the teaching of the church are ridiculed or despised in the world and even in the church. It is an astounding thing. Sometimes even, you know, when I hear, you know, Catholics like, are you really going to have more children? Really? Seriously? What's wrong with you? Or people, I mean, they feel that they need to make comments on the number of children that people have. I'm just like, who does that? First of all, this is rude and obnoxious. But second of all, you know, people, you know, even if people, for whatever reason, you know, don't have children, then sometimes they look at, well, how can you only have one child? You know, what are you contraceptive? Well, now it's crazy, right? Okay, just don't even go there. You don't need to go there. But in this paragraph was the basis for what has come to be known as John Paul II's theology of the body. Now, here at Prince of Peace, we are super, super blessed. I was going to say lucky, but blessed to have two staff members for whom this is in many ways their bread and butter. Stephanie Laster, who's with us today, who's our director of family life. Theology of the body is one of her big things. I mean, as a theologian from Belmont Abbey, this is one of her things. And then Angela Calabro, who is our director of catechesis and evangelization. You know, her master's work in theology at Maryvale was focused very tremendously on the theology of the body, and her thesis is on all these kind of things as well. So this is really great to have in a parish, you know, two staff members with professional resources in this. This is not my thing, you know, not my circus, not my monkeys, right? So dogma's my thing. So I'm glad that we have people like Stephanie and Angela doing all this stuff. It's great. But with this theology of the body, a truly new but profoundly traditional turn in moral theology underscores the positive value of sex and marriage in the Christian life. It really is a great thing. Now, however, for all of the teaching contained in the popes and in Vatican II, the issue of contraception would prove to be the testing ground for the reception of Vatican II's elevated view of Christian family. Okay, now, important to remember, we have to kind of back the train up a little bit. In 1963, Pope John XXIII put together a commission of theologians, bishops, and laypeople to study the question on birth control. Now, among those people was a certain Archbishop of Krakow in Poland, Karol Wojtyła, who would later become, of course, John Paul II. Now, they presented their findings 3 years later to Paul VI, voting 30-5 that the Church's teaching on the intrinsic evil of artificial contraception was in doubt. Interesting. Nevertheless, it's important to state the facts as they are, right? Nevertheless, 2 years later, Pope Paul VI, who had actually been involved as a young Monsignor in the drafting of Casti Connubii, issued the famous encyclical Humanae Vitae. In it, he stated, quote, conforming to fundamental principles of the human and Christian vision of marriage, we must once again state that there must be excluded absolutely, as the licit way in which to regulate births, the direct interruption of the generative process. End quote. Everybody was expecting this commission to say it was okay. The commission comes back with its findings 2 years later. Paul VI issues this encyclical. It was crazy. Protests came from everyone, from cardinals to grandmothers, about the upholding of the traditional teaching. In this country, academics signed protest and priests urged penitents to ignore the document. There's a book which was published, I don't have my notes of this, it was published very recently called The Coup at Catholic University, which talks about what happened at Catholic University of America in Washington in 1968, which documents the whole process by which most of the professional moral theologians in the United States at the time, and a significant amount of the clergy of the Archdiocese of Washington, signed public letters of protest against Humanae Vitae. Okay. Paul VI, though, you know, regardless of what you think about Humanae Vitae, he proved to be a prophet. Okay. In his discussions of the vastly rejected encyclical, he made four predictions of what would happen if artificial contraception would become the norm. Teenagers will be lulled into a false security about sexuality. Okay. Snapchat people, come on. Okay. Women would begin to be treated with less respect as rape, incest, and domestic violence would be on the rise. Governments would begin to plan families by law. And man would begin to think that he had unlimited dominion over his own body. They laughed at him. They're like, you're crazy. This is just about having, like, you know, eight children instead of nine. Come on. They laughed him to scorn. Okay. All of this and more has come to pass. Now, what has happened in the Catholic Church as a result is widespread dissent from the teaching of the Church, from bishops and theologians to couples and teenagers. But a dissent which often has refused to take into account the actual arguments of the Church against artificial contraception. One of the things that I keep kind of coming up against, and remember when we had the synod, okay, and there were the questionnaires and stuff that were going all over the world, and it was apparent to everybody in the Church, from Pope Francis down, that the vast majority of Catholics did not really entirely, not only buy into, but really understand a lot of the Church's teaching on these things. And, you know, I remember when I was studying in France in preparation for my doctoral work, you know, I became friends with a bunch of complete, you know, hedonist secularists who were great people. I mean, they were a lot of fun. We'd go to the beach on the weekends and, you know, speak French and, you know, have a good time and all that. It was really, really, really wonderful. And there were several of these people who were involved in working for the United Nations and doing all this stuff. Remember, there's this guy, a really, really fun guy from the UK, who was going to Mozambique, and you know he, you know, engages me in the middle of the, I mean, it's like a Saturday at the beach, right? The last thing I want to get into is conversation about Humanae Vitae, right? And so he's like, well, you know, I don't understand. You know, if the Pope would just say that we could use condoms, it would be so helpful. And I was like, okay, I need another beer for this conversation. But so I was like, well, what do you mean by that? And he was like, well, you know, all this disease and all these unwanted pregnancies and all this kind of stuff. And so I was like, well, what do you think that the Catholic Church's teaching is? And he's like, well, I don't really know. And I was like, well, why are you rejecting what you can't even formulate yourself? Give me another beer. I've got to get into this, right? And so for a couple of hours with people who, you know, had no connection with the faith at all, you know, I tried to kind of lay out as best as I could the teaching of Humanae Vitae and the kind of fear that Paul VI had and these things that I just mentioned. And they were like, well, that's totally different. And I said, well, exactly. I said, I understand where you're coming from, and I respect your conscience and what you're trying to do and all of that. I said, but read the document. You know, read Humanae Vitae. Read the theology of the body of John Paul II. There's a lot more wisdom than you can imagine there. But it just, you know, kind of impressed upon me that there's so many people that they reject the Church's teaching, but then when you start kind of scratching beneath the surface, there's, you know, some filling out that kind of needs to happen there. Now, the whole controversy over Humanae Vitae is perhaps the foremost indicator of the reception of Vatican II and the Church's magisterium. Okay. Now, Vatican II, if you look at it under the rubric of the hermeneutic of continuity, well, it's not going to have a problem with Humanae Vitae, right? It just kind of builds on what went before. But seen under the hermeneutic of rupture, it indeed ruptures not only one aspect of the Church's moral teaching, but a lot of the vitality of the Church's life itself. I mean, this is where, I mean, you could easily say, well, this is just kind of one issue and some people had some problems with it. It's really interrelated with everything, including the reception of the Council itself. Much of what happened in the aftermath of Vatican II has so little to do with Vatican II. Okay? It came about because many Catholics no longer saw the Council under aggiornamento and ressourcement, of opening the doors of the church to the modern world in the context of a hermeneutic of continuity, but solely through the prism of the rejection of Humanae Vitae. Many Catholics have left the practice of the faith altogether, and many of those who have stayed in as dissenters, and I'm going to say something very strong here, have sterilized their spiritual capacity to generate children. One of the things that we have seen in so many places in the life of the church is that where this kind of dissent against Humanae Vitae has been so insidious and so strong is that the practice of the faith has disappeared. So there's no vocations, okay? There's no baptisms, there's no marriages. It's really quite interesting to see the connections here. And then you see places in which the church's teaching is, you know, and there's very few places, I'll tell you, which is kind of presented and engaged and lived much more seriously and intentionally. And those numbers are entirely different. Okay. Now, of course, I'm not a statistician, so, you know, it would be important to look at these things, you know, very, very closely. But it's a really fascinating thing. Catholics who have embraced the culture of dissent paved the way for what John Paul II would call the culture of death. You know, you can say, I ain't having all these children, all you want, that's fine. But the consequences of that in the life of the church have really been quite tremendous. What this means, though, is that the church of the future is going to be a vastly different church than that of the immediate post-Vatican II era. One of the things that Benedict XVI said as Cardinal Ratzinger in the late 1960s, and this is a quote that kind of keeps coming up, is, you know, he says, the church of the future will be much smaller. And the thing is that, you know, sometimes people say, well, see, he just wants the church to be smaller. So, okay, well, you know, we just want to be strict and, you know, make sure that anyone who doesn't toe the line is, you know, totally cast into the outer darkness. And so, of course, the church is going to be smaller because, you know, you've irritated everybody out of the church, right? Well, what he's looking at is he's looking at just the demographic reality of a culture of contraception and abortion. It is as simple as that. And as well as the effect that dissent on the attack on the heart of family life, what that has on the practice of the faith, it really is more significant, I think, than people realize. But it is something that, you know, Benedict XVI, you know, in the 1960s saw very clearly. And remember, Benedict XVI was you know, not a dyed-in-the-wool, you know, neo-Thomist traditionalist by any stretch of the imagination. But again, these are realities that the church is coming to terms with. At the same time, you have Catholic families who have remained faithful to the church's teachings, okay? They are handing on the faith to their children. And very often, it is from them, as well as from conversions to Catholicism, because of its moral stance, the vocations to the priesthood and religious life are flourishing. It is a very interesting thing to see. And the Center for Applied Research and the Apostolate, ICADA, who is kind of the statistical arm that studies a lot of trends in the church, I mean, we're seeing a lot of this. Archbishop Heenan of Westminster, so that's England, when the preparatory schema of Gaudium et Spes was going on, he said it was unworthy of an ecumenical council of the church. Okay. For the senior churchmen in England to just kind of throw that out there, that's kind of a big deal. You know, he was not happy with the original draft. It grew from a document, the original schema was 29 pages, to almost 100. It was approved 2,309 to 75. But after 3 years of intense reworking, and in the end, no one was entirely happy with the document. Some have suggested that the document should really be called not by its first two Latin words, Gaudium et Spes, joy and hope, but by the next two words in the Latin text, Luctus et Angor, grief and anxiety. The 43 years of belabored interpretation of the council, which have elapsed since the Second Vatican Council was closed with a solemn mass on December 8, 1965, have been one in which the church and all mankind has experienced joy, hope, grief, and anxiety. You know, John Paul II expressed his belief that after the council, we would experience a new springtime in the church. This was something that he was talking about very frequently. Pope Benedict XVI, when he was reigning, this kind of theological and pastoral project to guide the church in her living of Vatican II in the light of tradition, I think was very important because it was bearing fruit for a new springtime. The work that John Paul II and Benedict XVI were doing, it was very, very important for kind of correcting the weirdness after Vatican II, of saying, okay, let's kind of, you know, engage the theology, engage these things. Not everybody was all on board with these things. I mean, that has to be said. But I think that a lot of fruit has come from the work of those two particular popes. Gaudium et Spes foresaw correctly that families faithful to the church would bring this about. Paragraph 52. Christians, redeeming the present time and distinguishing eternal realities from their changing expressions, should actively promote the values of marriage and family, both by the examples of their own lives and by cooperation with other men of goodwill. Thus, when difficulties arise, Christians will provide, on behalf of family life, those necessities and helps which are suitably modern. To this end, the Christian instincts of the faithful, the upright moral consciences of men, and the wisdom and experience of persons versed in sacred sciences will have much to contribute. End quote. Now, here we are towards the end of Gaudium et Spes. I want us to think back to the first document of the council, Sacrosanctum Concilium, which set out the project of Vatican II as follows. Quote, "The Sacred Council has several aims in view. It desires to impart an ever-increasing vigor to the Christian life of the faithful, to adapt more suitably to the needs of our own times those institutions which are subject to change, to foster whatever can promote union among all who believe in Christ, to strengthen whatever can help the call, the whole of mankind, into the household of the church." End quote. Perhaps the springtime of renewal so longed for by the fathers at Vatican II, by John the 23rd, Paul the 6th, John Paul the 2nd, Benedict the 16th, by Pope Francis, and all truly Catholic faithful will come about after all, as our Christian families turn towards Christ our hope and give that hope to a grieving and anxious world with joy. Glory be to the Father, and to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit. Okay. Gaudium et Spes. Thoughts, questions, anxieties, joys, sorrows. Luctus angor, Gaudium et Spes. Yeah.
By your last note, I'll answer today. Did Vatican II do what it set out to do?
Well, did Vatican II do what it set out to do? What do you think? No, not yet. Some of it. Work in progress. What is it? We're still answering that question. I think we really still are answering that question. You know, the implementation of a council is, because remember we're talking about the council itself, like the event, what happens. Then you have the implementation of the council, and then you have the reception of the council. Those are three kind of distinct moments that are all related. I think that, you know, it's important to recognize that Vatican II is a very unique council in many respects, you know, because of just the events and the intention behind it. Its implementation has been received very differently in different places. And some of that was kind of derailed by the whole kind of controversy over Humanae Vitae. And then the reception of the council is also another thing. What does it mean to have received Vatican II? That's a really interesting question. And I think that is something that we're still kind of really struggling with. If you look at some of the documents, you think, you know, the way that the fathers talk about the world in Gaudium et Spes, I mean, it's very admirable, right? It's, you know, I mean, they're dealing with all kinds of very serious things and say, hey, the church is the message of hope to the world. We can bring this. It's a wonderful thing. But then you think, but there's also original sin. There's also all kinds of craziness. And, you know, we got to address these things in some way, and optimism isn't always going to cut it. But, you know, how do you do that and still, you know, keep Pope alive? I mean, yeah, it's some really interesting things. Give out a question.
Are there, uh, the four concerns of the Holy Father in the document itself?
Okay, the four concerns in the document are actually spread out over all kinds of allocutions and things. Okay. So yeah, they're kind of culled from various things. So yeah,
In the mindset where the flock is led by the shepherds, and I've often heard the church is not a democracy, and things like that. But you mentioned things earlier, like the response to Humanae Vitae. There were documents of dissent, letters of dissent written by grandmothers and cardinals. And how can bishops and cardinals and priests, don't they have a vow of obedience? How do they get away with? Because the flock is going to follow their leaders, and if the leaders are vocally not obedient to the documents from the magisterium, then how are they allowed to stay in clerics?
Right, right. If I had an answer to that question, then we wouldn't be here. Well, because remember, like, when we talk about authority in the life of the church, remember that, you know, if you have this idea of the authority of the church is the pyramid, right? Okay, you got the Pope, the cardinals, and all this kind of stuff. Then, and you view it in that kind of structure, then if you view everything as, checking the boxes and toeing the line, then it's like three strikes, you're out kind of thing, right? If you view the church as Lumen Gentium kind of sees it, as this communion of persons and people and things and all of that, it takes on a little bit, the whole concept of authority in the church is a little bit different, because there is, within the context of Vatican II, a significant recall to the life of the church of the idea of conscience, right? And so there were many Catholics who, as these things were coming out, you know, they're like, okay, I'm not just going to sit here and pray, pay, and obey anymore, whether I'm father or cardinal or, you know, Joku Catholic, you know, whatever. You know, they had an idea that, okay, I have to inform my conscience and I have to respond accordingly, which is true to Vatican II. Right now, of course, Vatican II is also saying, but in order to form your conscience, all this stuff is kind of part of the mix there to get it right. Right. So many people within the life of the church, their whole reaction to this was not because they didn't want to be Catholic. It's because they really did feel in their conscience that after having studied these things to the extent that they studied them, that they were unable to assent. Now, couple that again with the whole idea that, remember how we talk about the munera we talked about in the first class, of teaching, governing, and sanctifying the church, right? The governing office of the church is again something which is not pyramidal. Right. But is kind of, you know, I shared, you know, my one professor from the Greg who says that, you know, communion is the idea of like concentric circles. Right. Because of that, that means that there is this constant kind of engaging in dialogue with people, so that there's a respect for the freedom of expression. The problem with that, though, is that there's a limit to it. Because at a certain point, you know, the church says, okay, this is getting out of hand because it could scandalize the faithful or create other problems. And so the church has this process through the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith for correction, in one sense. And individual bishops and bishops' conferences have a parallel thing. Having it doesn't mean that it's actually used or worked. Couple that with the idea that John the 23rd really said, okay, you can't just, you know, throw the obedience card at people, right? You know, you have to engage them. And because it would be very easy for the church to be like, you know what, all y'all excommunicated, period. Okay, it would be so simple, right? But the church is like, okay, no, we're not going to hurl anathemas at people, right? We're going to engage them, we're going to dialogue with them, and then eventually we're going to get around to the truth. The positive aspect of that, and I think there is a positive aspect of that, is that it does recognize that all of us are in different places when it comes to all of these teachings, right? And so you do meet people where they are. You do begin to kind of bring them along. Now, of course, when you're dealing with cardinals and bishops and stuff, you kind of assume that at least they vote the party line, right? Okay, but that's not the case, because they're also trying to figure all these things out at the same time. So this is where, you know, you see that the church is much more kind of complex in its life than that. Now, that having been said, remember that, and I go back to something, I'm really getting in trouble for so many things for this class, but in the Middle Ages, okay, there was a conception of two different cathedras. I'm really going to get in trouble for this, but that's okay. Okay. You know how the cathedra is the seat of the bishop, right? So you go to a cathedral. It's called a cathedral because there's a big, huge chair, right? Okay. It's a symbol of authority. In the Middle Ages, there was this idea of the cathedra magistralis and the cathedra episcopalis, the cathedra of the teacher and the cathedra of the bishop. Okay. There was an idea that the theologians had their own kind of authority, right? And that the bishops had their own authority as well. With Vatican I, remember Vatican I was all about the Pope, and then the Franco-Prussian War happened, and then they didn't really get to anything else. So then Vatican II, it's like, okay, let's talk about the bishops. The bishops had this sense of, we're the ones, you know, who have the kind of ultimate authority together as a college of bishops in union with the Pope. That was a big thing with them, right? And the interesting thing is the theologians were obviously very involved in the discussions of Vatican II. But when we're talking about discussing things, remember that once upon a time, when you were exercising the cathedra magistralis, right, then you were usually doing it in a classroom far removed from everybody else. And then theology would kind of advance, you know, little by little by this kind of very patient dialogue that would go on over centuries. But it was almost an entirely scholarly pursuit. Remember at Vatican II, this is the Council of the Media, right? All of a sudden, theologians are saying things which they've been saying for decades in the privacy of their own classrooms that all of a sudden are being reported in Time magazine, right? Now, you know, when a theologian, you know, has a brainwave about anything, he tweets it, right? Okay. So there's not the kind of sufficient, you know, distance and allowing for reflection for the cathedra magistralis as there once was. And this is related to a whole concept, which is a super important concept of academic freedom. Now, this is a thorny issue here. And here I'm speaking as a theologian. Okay. It is very important for a theologian who is supposed to be a scientist of revelation, in some sense, to have the freedom to engage everything he needs to engage and to say those things that he feels is correct. He has to have that freedom. Now, Ratzinger, of course, was a theologian. When he was the prefect of the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith, he wrote a very awesome document called The Ecclesial Vocation of the Theologian, in which he reminds theologians that, you know, guys, this is not just something you kind of do out there on the ether. It's something that you do in communion with the church. It's, you know, theology done on one's knees, as John Paul II says. Theologians have a responsibility towards the entire church to be very prudential the way that they formulate the things that they formulate, and that they also have to be very careful to engage with the cathedra episcopalis. Often theologians around the time of Vatican II were like, well, I'm a theologian and I'm the professional, and, you know, Bishop, man, you are obviously an idiot, and just go build churches and shut up about theology, right? Which is a problem, right? At the same time, though, the bishops themselves often, you know, did not engage, or especially since the council, have not engaged the theologians the way that they could have. So there's this kind of, you know, gradual splitting apart of the world of academic theology and the world of the bishops. And it is a huge problem because they need to kind of inform each other and they need to kind of help each other out a little bit. When it comes to like the question of academic freedom and things like that, you know, a lot of theologians, you know, when they have been kind of investigated by Rome or by their bishops' conferences, you know, they will go immediately and have a press conference about it because they're like, well, how dare you say these things? Well, this is part of the problem. It's not an idea of communio. And the thing is, again, you know, the church wanting to use the medicine of mercy, as John the 23rd said, is not going to come down like a ton of bricks immediately, partially because the experience of doing that with the modernist crisis in the Nouvelle Théologie ended up like just burrowing everything underground and then causing problems later. So It's a complex thing. I think that there has to be, and you may be very surprised to hear me say this, I think there has to be a greater sense of academic freedom for theologians to go about doing their work. But those theologians have got to be responsible in their prudential way of formulating these things. And they also have to be humble enough to present their things to Rome, particularly, and to the bishops, knowing that the bishops are examining these things, you know, not because they want to get all up in their business, but, you know, for the good of the faith and the common good of our life together as Catholics. It is an interesting thing, the difference here. I think if we went back to this medieval notion of the two cathedrae, it would be very helpful. But right now, it's just kind of, you know, trench warfare. So, Steph, you had a question? Okay. Well, one of the interesting things about Vatican II is that, Perfecta Caritatis, which is the document on religious life, called orders of religious. So we're talking about, like, not diocesan priests, but, you know, monks, nuns, friars, members of societies of apostolic life, all that kind of business, to return to the charism of their founders, right? And to go through an internal renewal process of kind of going back to the sources. It was their own kind of version of res small, right? So it's like, okay, let's look at our life together as a community. What are we really supposed to be doing here? And what is kind of accretions to that we've kind of done for a while but isn't really necessary? And so the process by which religious communities went through that, because they were kind of just trusting, you know, in Holy Ghost power to make this happen. And so there were certain communities who did this very well, I think, in many respects, and kind of remained intact, and, you know, that kind of guided the process along really well. And then there were communities that just fell apart entirely. Now, when we talk about different religious orders in the church, you know, obviously it's part of the diversity of the church that there are different kind of spiritualities that are all authentically Catholic, right? But they have very different kind of emphases. You know, if you're a monk, you're not going to have the same relationship to the poor or to learning or to, you know, private prayer as you would if you were a Sister of Charity of St. Vincent de Paul, right? So already within the church, there's a great kind of sense of diversity of these things. It kind of, you know, coexists in a nice area. And even in the area of theology, you know, there were very significant schools of thought which were very different. So, for example, you know, the early Thomists were very opposed to the doctrine of the Immaculate Conception, whereas the Franciscans were like, this makes perfect sense, this is great, right? So you still had these marked differences within them. Today, we're in a situation in which, depending on how communities went about their own renewal in the immediate post-Vatican II period, it often kind of colors how they do things now. So I'll give you some examples. I'll give you, you know, a couple of examples that are very interesting. The Sisters of the Immaculate Heart of Mary in California were a community which allowed a psychologist who was very much versed in Jungian psychology to guide the facilitation of their renewal. Within a year, the community had entirely imploded. The sisters were at each other's throats like only nuns with bad manners can be at each other's throats. The entire community disintegrated. So the community does not exist anymore. Now, would it have been useful to have a psychologist as part of the facilitation of these things? Well, yeah, you know, that's fine. But look at that in one sense. Then look at a community like the Dominicans of the St. Joseph Province, or in the northeast of the United States. The Dominicans of the St. Joseph province, you know, kind of, you know, I mean, they accepted Vatican II, they accepted the sin, but they were very slow to just kind of change everything from one day to the next. And it was like, okay, let's kind of do this very gradually. Everybody in the community is going to be a part of this, you know. And, you know, they went through a period of, you know, a little bit of experimentation, but it was all kind of closely guarded by their superiors. Now it is one of the most flourishing communities of men religious in the United States. You know, but then you also have to think, okay, in the post-conciliar period, is it good to have certain religious communities that are doing different things? One of the things that has happened in the life of women religious is that before Vatican II, many women religious were involved almost exclusively, to a large degree, in education and healthcare. And so many sisters afterwards are like, well, you know, we don't have to just do those things. I mean, we can be open to all kinds of other things. And so many communities, you know, went out to do all kinds of pretty amazing things, actually, and very creative things in ministry. But what often happened, well, I shouldn't say often, but sometimes happened, is that then they would adjust their community life in such a way that they began to lose a sense of their corporate identity. And religious life began to suffer. And then, you know, women who were looking at joining religious life, you know, would look at this and be like, why would I do this? I mean, how are you any different than, you know, and I think this is an overstatement, but how are you any different than a social worker? You know, you have an MSW, you know, you do the work of a social worker, you know, you look like my grandma, you know, and there's nothing different, and you live in an apartment by yourself. How is this any different than anything else? Now, that having been said, I mean, you know, the Spirit blows where it wills, and so I think that it's important, you know, not to necessarily be too quick to judge communities that went through that internal process. You know, there was this great woman in Charleston who, you know, she was absolutely wonderful. She just died very recently, so pray for her soul. But, you know, she was a traditionalist of the old school. And her famous thing was, Father, you know, we know that the church is going to be back when Mass is in Latin and priests and nuns put the clothes back on. So, so because there was this idea that, you know, you're a real nun if you wear a habit, by God, you know. But then again, but it doesn't take into consideration also the fact that, you know, the original habits of the sisters were often the very conservative lay dress of the day that became kind of frozen in time. Is there something about an external religious habit that is lived in the vow of poverty and all that, which is a very powerful thing? I think there is. And I think that some communities have certainly lost a lot in that. But at the same time, you know, and thinking about, you know, like the Jesuits, you know, I mean, I think of the Jesuits. I mean, you know. Oh, of course, yeah. I mean, I'm a survivor, 5 years with the SJs. And I often, you know, I love to make Jesuit jokes. It's great. You know, and it's great because also on my way to the Gregorian every morning, I would stop by the Church of Dolce Apostoli, where Clement XII is buried, who suppressed the Jesuits in the 18th century, to pray for the suppression of the Jesuits once again. But no, the Jesuits are interesting because one of the things that is so common to their spirituality from the beginning of St. Ignatius is this whole idea of discerning the spirit in the midst of the world, which is why, you know, if you wanted a Jesuit to go to some godforsaken place in like Eskimo land or the jungles of God knows where, or to go to the moon or whatever, you pick a Jesuit for that, right? Because part of their spirituality, this Ignatian spirituality, is the discernment of the spirit of God in the world, like wherever it is, in a way in which a monk who needs his cloister and his chant and his altar and all of that, this is not going to work as well. So the Jesuits particularly have this kind of charism of pushing the boundaries, right, of evangelization. And I think that that's awesome. I think that's wonderful. It's one of the great things that the Jesuits have to bring to the church. Are they going through their own kind of thinking of how to be faithful to Vatican II and be faithful to that in the midst of a changed world? They are. Is it possible to look at some of what they're doing and be like, dude, really, seriously? Are you a Christian? I mean, what? You know, So I think that, you know, that the church has a responsibility to kind of guide the religious orders a little bit and say, okay, maybe we're going a little bit outside of the bounds of what's really possible here. You know, but then again, with the Jesuits, you know, within their own community, there's this great sense of diversity of apostolate and charism, which is bred into the order. So you want to kind of keep that. But at the same time, you know, there's got to be something recognizably Christian, recognizably Catholic there. One of the most kind of things that was just so interesting about Jesuit universities, that they're all about academic freedom, but sometimes to the extent of even promoting things, which are like, really? I mean, you know, do you need to be showing the vagina monologues in, you know, college dorms on campuses? And is that really helpful just because academic freedom? I mean, you know, but this is all over my pay grade, right? But again, it's kind of, you know, a cue that a lot of these religious orders have been trying to, going through their own identity crises. And some of them will survive, and some of them will fail. And sometimes that's okay. Sometimes certain religious communities were founded for a very specific reason that then is no longer, and so then the religious community passes away and it's not a big deal. So, yeah. You're talking about Amoris Laetitia.
So this is the latest document that put out on marriage and families as a result of the synod.
Right. Okay. So, well, let me preface my comment on Amoris Laetitia and Pope Francis with one of the difficulties of the post-conciliar period is that the sheer volume of stuff. That, remember, we're talking about the documents on the liturgy, and then they like contradict each other, and trying to figure all this stuff out, 1700 pages of all this stuff. One of the difficulties is to try to absorb all of the stuff, because remember, this is not all just coming out from Rome, it's coming out from individual bishops and bishops' conferences, and to absorb this in any way that's actually helpful is a gargantuan task for theologians, for pastors, and for the faithful. I mean, it is. And it's important how you kind of see how all these things work together as pieces of a puzzle. So when we're talking
about my specific question, Chris, it probably more relates to how far have we got from Costi Canubi? Because in this
right.
document, it's in chapter 7, and it seems to be the one that I'm going to have, and I'm still scratching my head trying to figure out. Because I don't have a lexicon. Everybody's got their own when we talk about marriage being constant.
Sure.
I have a different idea. When we talk about conscience, people have a different idea.
Right.
Is it an educated conscience? Is the person, are the couple, are they living a good spiritual and holy life, or receiving sacraments? There's a lot that goes into it. And
I don't
think that many of the priests that talk to these people in confession are properly trained and grounded from their seminary training to get involved in those kinds of discussions with the penitents that are coming in and asking.
Right. Well, I mean, if we look at, you know, John Paul II, Familiaris Consortio, which is the big kind of document about marriage and family life, which was also came out after a synod, you know, there's this kind of linear development that's there. So you have Casti Connubii, you know, you have Humanae Vitae, you have Familiaris Consortio, what Gaudium et Spes, Familiaris Consortio. You have all these things that are kind of building on each other. But there are significant shifts in emphasis. Casti Connubii talks about the two ends of married life as the procreation of children and the union of the spouses. But it's very clear that one has precedence over the other. In Gaudium et Spes, the way that one could interpret the ends of marriage is almost as an equality of the ends of marriage, not as one is absolutely more important than the other. Because remember, you're adding in this kind of element. We're no longer talking about marriage as a subset of moral theology, which is a subset of canon law, right? We're talking about an entirely different thing that's going on. So to flesh that out, you're bringing in all kinds of stuff, right? You're bringing in not just what marriage is according to a canonical legal conception, but how does marriage fit into the original plan of salvation, right? Which is a big theme of John Paul II. How does it fit into the dignity of the human person? How does it fit in all these things? Well, then, if you fast forward to Pope Francis, remember that one of the things that Pope Francis is very concerned about, and justly, is that there are lots of people in the world who find themselves in positions of tremendous pain and suffering because of failed human relationships. So he's looking at this and thinking, okay, how do we as a church address the reality of these situations? Amoris Laetitia is an attempt, after the synod, to reformulate some of the traditional doctrine from Casti Connubii, Gaudium et Spes, Humanae Vitae in Familiaris Consortio, in a way which pastors use to be more accessible to people who are in situations which are not the ideal kind of family which is described in Gaudium et Spes. I think that this came from the bishops really kind of coming to terms with the fact that their people are not on board with all of this for a whole variety of reasons, from the culture of dissent, right, to just not being ever taught, to all kinds of things. At the same time, though, remember that, you know, at Gaudium et Spes time, you know, you're dealing with, okay, the contraception question, okay, you know, some divorce going on. Now we're dealing with an entirely different world, because not only do you have those questions, but you have, you know, more of the abortion question, but you also have questions of sexual orientation and gender ideology, which are an entirely new kind of thing. And the personalist and the humanist kind of shift with John Paul II's theology of the body opens a lot of significant kind of, depending on how you look at breaches in the wall, or openings for creative thinking on these things. But we're just now beginning to even think about these things. And of course, if you're thinking, but there's also like danger signs in some of these things as well. I mean, how do you keep the family together with all of these other kind of things that are there, while the church is still trying to reflect on all these things theologically? With Amoris Laetitia, and I have to admit, I've read the document once, and it is a huge document, and there's a lot there, and it's, again, one of those things, how do you absorb all of this? And I think that the church is going to be absorbing it for a very long time. But then you also have to look at, we talked about the different levels of ascent according to different church documents. Amoris Laetitia is a very interesting document in the fact that it is an apostolic exhortation after a synod, which carries some weight, but not nearly as much weight as a papal encyclical or whatever. But also Pope Francis in the document seems to kind of discount the need to look at apostolic exhortations as being definitively binding. So it's a weird document where the genre of the document itself and the assent required to it is kind of put into question. So it's like, well, what do you do with that, right? So ultimately, I think that, you know, we take what is good from Amoris Laetitia and we say, hey, that's great. And then those other things which, you know, seem to be kind of problematic or questionable, you know, we bring those to further dialogue and we bring those to greater study. Particularly the eighth chapter of Amoris Laetitia, which has created a lot of consternation. And we have a situation in which we have cardinals of the church who have publicly stated that the document is binding on all the faithful, and it is not binding on all the faithful. So when, you know, the guys in red can't figure this out, then there's a problem. And I think it goes back to, you know, Vatican II and Gaudium et Spes. Remember how the original document was 29 pages, right? I really think that the Council Fathers, and this is me editorializing, so feel free to totally throw this out, but I think that the Council Fathers were like, okay, there's a lot of crazy stuff going on in the world, and we've got to address it, and because people are looking to us for guidance, and we're going to throw everything, including the kitchen sink, in this document that we can, right? Because people need guidance on these issues. When you do that, though, right, remember how we talked about every council resolves questions and then opens other ones? Gaudium et Spes is like Pandora's box, right? There's all kinds of stuff up in there that, you know, really great stuff and lots of questions that can come out of it. The church, in her magisterial teaching, has been talking and talking and talking and talking and writing and publishing and all this stuff to such a volume, trying to basically, it almost seems like, you know, give exhaustive commentaries to the already exhaustive nature of Gaudium et Spes. in and of itself, and when the church has been put on a trajectory by John the 23rd to exhort and explain, it's understandable. I think that the church at a certain point has got to ask herself, are we absorbing all of this stuff? And is it time to stop talking and to listen? And even Pope Francis, remember how the whole thing, the methodology of the synod was very much listen to the faithful. Now, of course, you know, you have to listen to the faithful, but you also have to, like, you know, be faithful to Christ's teaching. I mean, you can't, the two really can't be in contradiction to each other. But I think that okay, let's just kind of let all of this post-conciliar teaching absorb into the life of the church a little bit more. And to do so calmly, because I think that a lot of these questions are so charged that, and also because of the mediatic way in which all of these things are being discussed, there's a lot of heat, but not a lot of light with some of these things. And now, of course, that having been said, in the meantime, we got to get people to heaven, okay? And we can't give people the idea that what is sin is not. So you have to give clear moral guidance. I think it's very important that the understanding of the way that the moral life of the church is presented, being done in a legalistic framework according to canon law, is useful because it's kind of easy to understand. Do this, don't do that. Very simple. Okay, if you do this, it's sin. Very simple. Reorienting it and integrating it into the whole idea of the moral life is the virtues which is flourishing towards beatitude, right, is a harder thing, but it's ultimately more fruitful and more productive. And I think that the church is kind of struggling with how to do that, how the renewal of moral theology can be presented to people. And in the meantime, there's all these questions that have come up that the church has to address. And the church can't just be like, well, no. The church does that sometimes, and it's important to do that. I mean, Pope Francis, you know, has said very recently, I mean, you know, gender ideology, no, he's not engaging it. It's just no. He even said in Sweden yesterday, people on the presser were like, you know, what about women priests? And he's like, no, period. but it is still important that that the church still engage these questions and to understand, okay, well, why is there this no for this? You know, how is it presented? Can it be presented positively? What does it mean for gender? What does it mean for ministry? And to really kind of delve into these things. But it has to be done calmly. And right now, a lot of these discussions are just not proceeding calmly at all. So, okay, one last question and then we'll send y'all home with Gaudium et Spes. So. Okay, so no more questions. I can't believe it. Wow. Okay, well, next week is our trying to pull all this together class. If we can do that, I mean, you know, I don't think we can, but we'll try. I want to try to talk about kind of the unresolved issues that are present as part of each of the four constitutions that we've talked about. So, okay, so excellent. Come see the clock because this is amazing. So. Right, so.